Welcome to the Fat Fueled Family Podcast, where every week we talk about things like nutrition, training,
how to live a healthy and active lifestyle with your little ones, peaceful parenting, education,
and of course, mindset.
Don't forget to follow us on Facebook and Instagram at Keto Counterculture, at Fat Fueled Mom, and at Fat Fueled Kids, and search for Fat Fueled Family on YouTube.
To stay up to date with everything we're doing, sign up with your email at www.fatfueled.family and check out our blog for workouts, meal ideas, and all the other cool stuff we love to talk about.
Don't forget to hit subscribe.
All right, welcome to the Fat Fueled Family Podcast. I'm Danny Vega, and I'm joined by my beautiful wife.
He always makes me say my name, Mauda.
Today, we're super excited because we have someone who, in private conversations, I've said over and over to this person that we need more people to learn about the things that he's talking about and writing about. But let me give you guys a quick introduction. Our guest is a writer, speaker, researcher, and practitioner whose main message is that the optimal human diet for health is grass-based and not grain-based, and that the only true sustainable form of agriculture is the production of livestock products from grazed forages. And if you don't know what forages are, we'll talk about that a little bit. He's a transition agent standing between consumers and producers, and he runs a blog, Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter page where he hopes to help both consumers and producers improve their health, change how they think about nutrition. He wants to help producers make changes in their production practices and help Oregon become a leader in grass-based livestock production. We have no one other than Peter Ballerstedt. How you doing, Pete? Say hello to our fans.
Hello, everyone. Happy Thanksgiving.
Yes.
Whenever you hear this, every day can be Thanksgiving. Thank you so much for that introduction.
Amen, man. Well, every day could be a day of gratitude. And even on tough days, when when you're having technical difficulties, there's always a learning experience to be to be gleaned from it. So we're just happy to have you, man. We're just really, really happy. When we wrote down this list of people we wanted to talk to, you were right at the top of the list.
Yeah.
So much. It was nice to meet you in Austin, and look forward. You know, we've had some conversations. Look forward to the next time that, you know, we can be together and share some more. It's an exciting time, really.
It is an exciting time.
I think so. I think that a lot of the, you know, with what you do, we've already gotten to the point where talking about the way we eat from a health standpoint, the other side, and we'll talk, you know, the plant-based side and all the things that they're losing a lot of traction on that end. They have very loud voices still. But I think the other side is even more, of an opportunity for us to go deeper. And that's the side about obviously not only what should we eat, but how should we feed ourselves? So I don't think there's anybody better to talk about this than you.
Well, thank you. And you said at the beginning about helping people learn what I know. And I also want to encourage people who have come across this, I would say, more informed view of human nutrition, to engage with people in agriculture because they need to know what we know on this side. And it goes both ways. I mean, we have so much to learn from each other, and too often we're just kind of at each other, and that's not helpful.
Definitely not. It's a weird, it's kind of bizarre when you think about it. You know, we should be working together, but
and it does make such a difference. Like, for example, we were just in Ohio, and just visiting the dairy farm is so much to learn. And you know, all the questions we could ask directly to the farmer, and he can tell us his point of view. And there's just all these things that we didn't know about either that, you know, get in the way of certain things. And it's not just easy all the time.
Yeah. Like, you know, when you're at the farm and you're talking to a human being and he's like, what am I supposed to do when a cow gets sick? You know, like, what am I not going to give my cow antibiotics? You know, what am I? So that's, there's all types of conversations that we should definitely bridge that gap. And I hope that, you know, this one episode and our podcast is one of the agents to do that.
Me too.
So, all right, let's first, the first question we always ask is, what is the most critical problem you're currently trying to solve?
A couple layers on this one. One is we are being overwhelmed in this country, but also around the world, with an epidemic of chronic disease. And the numbers are staggering, and there are certain layers to this that are probably much less controversial than others. If you would merely look at diabetes, that alone would be enough. And of course, now there's all this evidence that suggests that diabetes is but a part of a metabolic derangement that manifests as many different chronic illnesses. I think the figure that I just saw was that something just around 9.5% of GDP is the cost of chronic disease related to obesity overweight. That's almost twice the economic input of agriculture from producer through manufacturer, distribution, retail sales. It's enormous. And so there's that. And on the other side, we aren't alone in this world. There are people who live in many, many other parts of the world, and they are trying to emerge from poverty. They're trying to emerge into a more prosperous society wherever they are. And the messages that we are subjected to in this country and in the affluent West have a way of impacting the rest of humanity in countries that are trying to develop. And so if they're false, then that falsehood impacts them unfairly. So as we look out to the world of 2050, we're going to have a growing population, about 2 billion more people, it's estimated. We know that that's going to come with a demand for doubling food production. It's going to be accompanied by an increase in demand for animal protein of 2/3.
Wow.
How are we going to do that? And is that even an accurate number? Because probably that's based on what some expert somewhere thinks we ought to be eating.
Right? Exactly. Yeah, so it's way less than what we should be.
Right. Indeed. And I've heard it put something like, 1.5 billion vegetarians in the world would like to not be if they could afford.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's not that's even what, by choice. Dr. Georgia Ede
talks about that all the time. What is the percentage? It's like 80%.
It's a lot. Yeah, it's like 95% of the vegans worldwide or something. Don't
quote me on that.
Vegans.
Oh, vegans. Okay.
Is not by choice. It's because they live in in third world countries, and that's the cheap way to feed everyone is.
Well, that's what they think.
And that's what they thrive. That's what they think. They're just feeding people grains and.
Well, and if we get to some parts of the world, I mean, where is the refrigeration? I mean, what sorts of animal products are we going to provide that are shelf stable, that are deployable, that are affordable, that are appropriate for the culture that we're. Those are big issues, and so part of what I'm trying to advocate for is. Now I get cute, is I'm looking to promote the ruminant revolution.
Yes.
Just as we had to have a green revolution in the 60s and 70s to avoid famine and starvation for what then was a quarter of the world's population, we now have almost 3 billion people that are malnourished in some sense.
Yes,
that's out of 7.5 or roughly now. So now 800 million of those people are calorically malnourished. They don't have enough calories, right? So they're starving in that classical sense. But 2.2 billion are overweight or obese.
Right.
Wow. So, and that's one thing that people don't think about.
But that is malnourished.
You know, that these people are malnourished. Yeah, like you can even break that word down. They're
overfed,
wrongly,
but malnourished.
Yeah, wrongly nourished.
Yeah.
So that's You know, there are personal challenges and things like that. But in terms of a big sort of mission, you know, within the last month, I got to speak to a low carb conference and try to introduce them to the wonder that is the ruminant animal. And then the following week, I got to speak in front of a group of crop scientists that specialize in forages. These are my people. And introduce them to how wrong dietary policy has been and how that actually impacts what we can do in this branch of agriculture, which has the best story going as far as environmental footprint, sustainability, enabling prosperity for humanity. And people there don't know that story, right? That it, if you, you know, we tend to get siloed in all our disciplines. We don't frequently look out into other areas. And it's hard for people to understand just how bad it has been for just how long.
Yeah, and it's interesting that you're talking to both sides. It actually, it's funny because I'm going to ask you a question now that it's perfectly in line with this, because we talk about there's this lack of awareness and it's further complicated by misinformation. And so you have a lack of awareness from the consumer on how we should go about producing what we eat. I would say also what we should eat, but to a lesser extent, what we should eat. And then on the producer side, more of they may think they have or they at least are more familiar with production, but they are not as familiar with, you know, how we should eat. So I would like for you to first talk about what you do as a forage agronomist. And first, you know, for people to understand the difference between forage and things like, what's an example, like roughage. What's the difference between something like forage and roughage and, you know, cellulose and starches, things like that. Can you talk about that a little bit?
Sure. In animal nutrition, we typically have divided feedstuffs into two broad categories, roughages and then concentrates. And typically that's based on digestibility. So the more digestible feedstuffs are ones that called concentrates, have more energy per unit volume. So concentrate roughages and higher fiber feeds. And even in a ruminant animal, which is really good at digesting fiber, you know, really good digestion might be in the 60 to 70% range. Whereas if you feed starch to an animal, typically the digestibility needs to be up into the 90-some percent where there's a problem. So you get an idea of difference in terms of energy yield from feeds. Cellulose is the most abundant carbohydrate in the biosphere. This is the product of photosynthesis. Now, photosynthesis is taking carbon dioxide and water, and it's producing carbohydrates from that. So that includes sugars and starch. And starch is made up of many glucose units, just like cellulose is, but they're linked together differently. Because of that difference in linkage, no vertebrate animal, no higher life form produces the enzyme that's necessary to break down the bonds in cellulose or fiber.
It would be kind of sweet if we could.
Right.
Well, maybe it would, because we do see the problems that come from us utilizing the starch, which produce amylose, or amylase, which breaks down those bonds and gives us the same glucose. And we know the problems that we get into with glucose. Fortunately, we have all of these microorganisms, and many of them have over time developed this unique relationship with ruminant animals. So they live within the first two stomachs of this four-stomached animal, and it's they that produce the cellulase that allows that animal to utilize this high-fiber, low-fat, poor-quality protein diet and produce for us high quality animal protein, high quality animal fat, as well as bioavailable forms of minerals, various vitamins. So these are the key link in the energy flow from photosynthesis and through to us.
Love it. Yeah, that I definitely did not say that I wanted to be like a ruminant, and I was thinking like it would be cool if I could just stand outside like you illustrated at KetoCon, just put your hands out to the sun and just start, you know, photosynthesizing. Yeah. That would be sweet. Sun to me, like, yeah. Sun is zero calories, you know?
Zero cal.
right. But no, that doesn't work. And we can't eat raw rock either.
No, we cannot.
So we have to have some way for these nutrients to move, for the energy to flow. You know, the sun is obviously the big source of energy in our environment. And how do we then get tapped into that? Well, it's through plants, but it's primarily through the animals that are converting that energy and those forms into forms that we can utilize.
Exactly. Yep. It's so important. And I love the way you explain that. It just makes it so much easier to understand it being explained that way. Okay. So now that people are better aware of like what you do and should be clear that we should listen to you, you know what you're talking about. I think the majority of, you know, the crowd listening to our podcast really understands that we do favor a diet that's rich in meat, dairy, if you can tolerate it, and animal fats. But that being said, we know that the plant-based crowd has really lost traction on the question of what we should eat because nutritional science just doesn't support it. Thanks to all the trailblazers, though, in our current high-fat animal-based movement, people are actually eating more meat. I've even converted a few friends myself from, you know, not eating more plant-based to eating meat, and they're seeing the benefits. But let's move a little bit to the second question. And talk about how we should go about producing what we eat. So like maybe break it down like financial sustainability and then environmental sustainability, which is a big argument in the vegan community or plant-based community, talking that it's just not sustainable to feed humans animal meat, animal protein. So
right. So there's so many layers, and I use the image of, you know, a big thick rope that has many strands in that rope. And when they hand it to you, oh, that looks really strong. But if you can test each one of those strands of their argument, they break. Right. And pretty soon you're left with nothing. Yeah. Now at some point you may end up with someone who for their reasons chooses one path or another, and I really, you know, I don't want to force anybody to do anything against their will, right? But let's make sure that we're having a conversation about factual information so that we can reach truly informed decisions. And I don't want to get past the importance of personal health in the conversation about sustainability. And there are voices, and they tend to be perceived as extreme. When you become more familiar with the literature and movement, you find that they're actually foundational. But these are people who will minimize the value of human beings. And so at certain level, sorry, we've got a disconnect here, and I don't know how to ask that. But when we talk about sustainability, if we are not considering elements of a societal nature as well as elements of an economic nature and an ecological nature, and we're not having as full a conversation, and I would suggest we're not having an honest conversation.
Yeah, because usually when people neglect one of the three or two of the three, it's because, you know, one of them, they found a way to twist things or to you know, just mislead people on how that one, and don't, you know, put the blinders on and don't think about the other two and think about this little, you know, whatever gimmick I've now turned to try to get you to switch the other way.
Well, and sometimes it's just because, you know, if someone were to talk to me about, you know, weightlifting or exercise, right, it would not take very long to realize you're not talking to the right person. and I don't know. It's not an area that I've you know, frankly, spent a lot of time in. And when you talk to people who are really looking at this subject, you find people that are saying, there are lots of sides to this. Yeah. And if we don't consider them all, you know, there's pluses and minuses. There are costs and benefits to every single thing we do in life. The idea that there's one decision that you can make that has all upside, no potential, that's ludicrous. That's how we got to the dietary problem we're in now. People very confidently said, we can't imagine, almost a quote, we can't imagine any negative effects from following our dietary advice.
Well, that's scary.
Well, yeah, you need a better imagination. There are people talking to you at time saying,
yeah, well, you don't even imagine it anymore. It's just
we've at the time they had studies.
Oh yeah. And they were quieted. They were all exactly. quieted.
There were scientists trying to engage with politicians and advocates. And scientists were trained how to couch, they said, you know, so they talked about indications and suggestions, and you know, on the other side you had people who weren't encumbered by that kind of behavior. And so they just said, no, absolutely not. We're certain. And, you know, that kind of stuff we still have with us today. So there's that bit. There is also just some, you know, basic realities. The vast majority of the Earth's surface cannot be used to produce food directly utilizable by humans. Like less than 4% of the Earth's surface. I'm counting the ocean in that. So, you know, if you look at figures that are just land surface, it's obviously going to be bigger. But less than 4% of the Earth's surface is suitable for cultivation. Now we're learning a lot about whether cultivation itself is a good idea. That's a separate conversation. But in any case, so that's a very small portion of the Earth's surface that can be producing the commodity crops, grains, you know, and nobody's living on kale, right? I mean, you've got to get energy, and your energy is going to come from starch if you're not eating animal products, or it's
going to
come from industrial oils, plant oils of some kind. So that's that reality. At the same time, we've got like 14% of the Earth's surface is rangeland or permanent pasture land. Should not be cultivated.
And can you explain why is it that this land, is it just the soil is not suitable for anything other than, you know, grasslands?
Yeah. First of all, we ought to acknowledge that most of our cropland is in what would naturally be grasslands.
Yes, right. And that's one of the things. And you and I talked about this. And remember, my introduction to this was a book with, you know, a lot of good information, and obviously there was. The author had her own spin on things and her own very strong voice. And so when one of the things that blew my mind was the fact that, you know, for instance, modern North American, like arid lands used to be marsh because of what we've done to the soil. And because we were using this, this type of farming.
Let's take it another way. When the first European settlers got into the prairie, they referred to it as the Great American Desert.
Wow.
Because there were no trees.
Yeah.
And so they were used to trees. And so if there were no trees, it must be a desert. It is the most fertile, most productive land in the world. And these people thought they were walking across a desert because of their background, because of their interpretation.
Right.
The soil, the root mass was so great in that, you know, Midwest, you know, where you were just recently, that the plows that they had couldn't break it.
Wow.
They talked about the sound sod made as the plow cut through it. They said it sounded like cloth being torn.
Wow.
They built their houses out of blocks of sod. So I mean, this, we've gone a little bit, but just let's recognize that these very productive croplands around the world, you can see these, are in fact grassland biomes. Now, a lot of this rangeland is grassland that, as you said, because of soil conditions, because of altitude, because of the length of the growing season, because of rainfall patterns, any number of conditions mean that those soils are best used as permanent or long-term grasslands. The best example is when you went into southeastern Colorado, you know, that part of the United States where the Dust Bowl originated, you had grasslands that were taken out of grass and put into wheat production, in part because the government encouraged it for a number of geopolitical reasons, right. And they did it during an unusually wet period. And then that was followed by a, you know, return to more typical weather patterns and then a drought and a heat wave. And so they took the sod, they plowed it out, they destroyed that structure to the soil. That soil was then laid bare for erosion, wind, and water. And then we had that result. So that's what happens when we go into these areas of land that should not be cultivated and we try to cultivate.
Wow.
And it's interesting because there's kind of this there's this juxtaposition of wanting to develop and being mindful of developing a land in a way that's sustainable, and then at the same time recognizing what the land is, you know, recognizing that there's certain things that you just can't change, and then we have all these unintended consequences. And then, of course, then the weird thing is that the wheat production somehow always gets linked back to the meat. Like the wheat production is getting linked back to the cows. And you made this amazing comment in your speech at KetoCon that I was just like, wait, what? And that was talking about the... Can you speak a little bit about the percentage of a cow's life that's spent, you know, consuming forage versus wheat? Even a conventional, you know, feedlot cow, what is the typical time they spend, you know, consuming grass and things like what do they call it? Do they call
silage?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Versus like wheat.
Well, so. I, if I remember the moment that I heard the popping sound from your it was something about, you know, even in the United States, and so production systems vary around the world and they vary across the United States. The typical quote unquote grain finished steer, of its lifetime feed, less than 10% of that's going to be grain.
Wow.
Yeah.
Hey, everybody. Sorry to interrupt. I just wanted to let you guys know about a company we've been a fan of for over a year now. This is a really cool company because, number one, they're convenient. They make some delicious products, and they were also so cool when Dean had the accident. They sent us a great care package. The boys love their products. We love their products. They're convenient, and that's Real Good Foods. Real Good Foods has chicken crust pizzas, cauliflower pizzas. They have these awesome enchiladas that the boys love. Good products, low carb, keto friendly. And if you see the comparison compared to actual other packaged foods, there's no comparison. So they have a store locator. They're available at places like Walmart and supermarkets. I've also seen them even at Vitamin Shoppe, which is pretty cool. And if you wanted to shop for them locally, you can look at the store locator online. But we have a code, and it's FatFueledFam, and that'll give you $10 off your order. So if you're in a time pinch and you don't have time to cook yourself a nice home-cooked meal, definitely look into Real Good Foods. They get the Fat Fueled Family seal of approval. And without any further ado, back to our show.
And that's crazy, because you think about when I picture that cow, I'm picturing, and I never...
Well, because, you know, you see those images, it's powerful what they do.
But every time I'm driving around, I see cows grazing on pasture everywhere.
Yeah, they're always grazing on pasture.
Whatever state I'm in, it doesn't matter if I'm in Florida or Ohio, they're always grazing on pasture. So even in a feedlot operation, apparently they're going to have to, I guess, even if they have them in a feedlot, they're giving them, because the cows can't, the way I understand it, they can't take more than that, right? If they could, they probably
would. They'll just get too
sick. Yeah. So, you know, 4 to 6 months out of a 2 year at most lifespan, you're going to have this, a typical animal is going, a steer is going to be in that kind of a feedlot. So 4 to 6 months out of a 2 year lifespan. And it's probably going to be shorter than that in both senses. It's going to be a shorter period, and it's probably not going to be 2 years. But, you know, first 6 months plus or minus, you're going to have that is going to be a newborn calf, or then a growing calf suckling on mama cow out on pasture. And when a ruminant's born, its rumen doesn't function. So it's got to develop that functional rumen over time. And so it'll begin eating more pasture as it grows along. And then you're going to wean that animal from mama at, again, 5, 6, 7 months, depends. And then that animal will grow for an additional period of time, usually on pasture. Higher quality pasture than it was running on with mama, because mama doesn't need real high quality feed once she's mature, which is part of her niche. Now, once that animal reaches a desired weight, or it's a time when, you know, they need animals in the supply chain, then they move into a program of increasing content of concentrate or higher energy feed as part of a balanced ration. But that ration must always contain fiber. If it does not have sufficient fiber, if it gets imbalanced, actually either way, if an animal is eating too much fiber and has too little digestible carbohydrate, that's a problem. If the animal has too much digestible carbohydrate and too little fiber, that's a problem. So they're constantly monitoring and making sure that these animals are getting what they need for health as well as production targets. And again, when we get to the end of the deal and we say, okay, that steer is producing, you know, 700-pound, 800-pound carcass, it took less than 10% of its lifetime feed as grain, and then you can start looking into that and realize how little of that was actually human utilizable. And so there's all of these narratives that we've been confronted with.
Yeah.
First, it's bad for your health. Well, you know, people are backing off of that, but I will point out we just had a paper floated that was trying to come up with what the appropriate level of taxation would be to save however many, you know, quadrillion people.
Obviously. Oh,
wow.
They're saying that because of cancer, right? They're going to blame cancer on red meat consumption. So what's the proper level of tax to dissuade you? So
tax meat, you mean, right? Like to tax the red meat.
Exactly.
Wow.
So once again, the wealthy will pay it, and the poor will be oppressed and not be able to afford the even more food that they desperately need. Right, the nutrition that they need in service of this narrative. But that's kind of an outlier now. As you said, there you see this kind of shift away, because there really is no justification for any kind of narrative saying red meat consumption, chronic disease, or the causal link. So now we're going to rely on what's always been part of the conversation, but they just haven't been, you know, as upfront with the environmental story. But that's been part of it since they started the whole dietary guidelines thing.
Yeah.
So points to remember are, we don't have enough land to feed human beings today or in 32 years when we've got 2 billion more.
Wow.
That right now, ruminant animals, for example, which are primarily producing human utilizable food out of non-utilizable resources, are providing 15% of humanity's protein. And animal protein is more valuable to human nutrition than plant protein. So right. If you replace that 15%, you've got to replace far more. It's not a one-to-one swap. So there's just the simple reality of that. And then we can dig into each of the various stories about environmental impact. And seriously, every time you do, you find that the numbers are so different that you're left with saying people have been really misled by someone.
Yeah.
I think for most people, they just are repeating what they've heard. So I don't want to suggest that everybody who, you know, has a differing point of view than me is consciously lying. But I think that they're sincerely wrong.
Yeah.
Yeah. Believe what they're saying, and you know, so then it's a matter of, can we have a conversation, which I think is what's so powerful about what you're seeing and what so many other people are seeing, where people have been burdened with any number of these chronic diseases.
Yes.
And something finally breaks through, they make this decision, and they you know, kind of go this different way, and they find all these improvements in their health. And that's why I want to say to people, look, when you're improving your health, you are improving the world.
Yes,
that is so true.
And so let's kind of bring this conversation back, because we have to produce food somehow. We're not getting away from agriculture, right? It's not going to be someone's image of what agriculture was 100 years ago is not the solution, right?
I love that one. That's one that we're seeing a lot. And how do you scale something like that up?
Well, right now in the United States, we've got less than 10%. Oh, I think it's North America, so you know, Canada needs to be included. 10% of the world's cattle are in North America, yet 20% of the world's beef is produced by North America.
Wow.
So having less efficient forms of food production is an ecological cost.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
And I think a lot of people in other countries, it all depends. If we're talking about just from a financial standpoint, because, you know, there's certain cultures that are not going to do it for religious reasons or whatever. But I really do think it's a problem when someone like in this country, for instance, who's thinks they're doing the right thing, and I'm not blaming the consumer, because the consumer's just misinformed.
Right.
But they think they're doing something better by going to the store and grabbing, you know, that lettuce versus that meat, when whatever the vegetable is they're buying, there's chances are that it may be even coming from a different soil, from not even our own soil. And so, like, we're flying things all across the world. And we're using how much does that cost to do all those things?
Yeah.
We're getting things that are out of season, you know?
Yeah. And in a way, you know, it's a good thing that we are no longer dependent on the vagaries of climate in very small regions, right?
Yeah.
Because, you know, you read the stories of people who are you know, working to produce a crop, and then in one afternoon a hailstorm rolls through and the crop is ruined.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
Okay. So now what are you going to do? You got winter coming. You know, what is that? So in a way, I'd like us to kind of take a step back away from the conversation about the how. I'd like us to ask about, if we are right, and that's always useful to keep in mind, if we're right, then we need to be consuming more animal products and less of some of the plant products. Now, some people are finding, you know, they're entirely animal product based diets, and other people are finding some space in between two extremes.
Yeah.
But okay, so right now, humanity's diet is plant-based. The majority of our calories are coming from plant sources, and the majority of humanity's protein supply is coming from plant sources. And I think the last time I looked at the numbers, more protein was provided in our diet from cereals than from animal products. If it wasn't more, it was about equal. And that's a lousy source of protein.
It is.
And then there's all this really interesting information about how maybe the protein quality and quantity of our diet drives our ingestive behavior, so that if we're not getting enough protein of sufficient quality, we keep eating more than we would had we gotten enough and it was high enough quality.
Oh, absolutely.
All of these things are very interesting, but how do you put it all together and say, given that we have to do this, right? Because we can't photosynthesize. We can't eat raw rock. Everything we do is going to have an impact. Is it not in fact possible? And, you know, I can pull a paper that says the least harm principle may mean that in fact we need to be eating diets that include large herbivores rather than vegans, right? Not eating vegans. I mean,
because
even the cow isn't a vegan, right? The cow eats the microbes.
Yes, they're what do you call them? Microbians.
Yeah,
I love that. One of the things that you said was I chuckled in my mind because Maura says this all the time. Like when we eat the wrong foods, like when we're, let's say if we're eating that wheat and we're trying to get that satiety, our body's just telling us,
Try again.
Wrong. Try again. Yeah.
Try again.
Right. Wrong answer.
It's going to keep sending you those hunger signals because it's trying to get nutrition.
Yeah.
It's trying to get nutrients.
Yep. And then on top of that, you know, that protein comes with carbohydrate. That carbohydrate has an effect. So, I mean, teasing out any one of these things, but it's just so when we start having this conversation, then we need to also take on board, you know, 60% of adult Americans have one or more chronic illnesses. I think it's 12% and maybe 15, 5 or more.
Wow.
And what's the cost of that? I really don't care if you can tell me somehow that you're producing that wheat crop has a lower impact, right, in some environmental sense, if feeding it to the population produces that, because we know that that's not sustainable. But then we can look further and we can say, look, the best information that we have in the United States is that all of agriculture produces something like 9% of the total greenhouse gas, anthropogenic greenhouse gas emissions of the United States. 9%. That's all of agriculture.
Wow.
You know that all of animal agriculture represents less than half of that, about 4%. That's all of animal agriculture.
Nobody talks about that.
No, we talk about just the opposite, right? Yeah. Over half, somebody says. Oh, no, now it's 18%. Well, worldwide, it's like 14.5%. But the problem is you're looking at areas of the world that have very less efficient agricultural systems, and they have very smaller other aspects of their economies. So the number looks bigger. Right. Yep. But in the United States, if we just stick here and we look on a life cycle basis, beef is 2%.
Wow.
That's healthcare crazy. Industry is 10%.
Yeah.
So if arguably we could half the healthcare need by doubling beef consumption,
right,
be better off.
Wow, I've never heard that one. You know, I've never heard that about the healthcare
percentages.
It's carbon footprint.
So again, it's complicated. You know, you start looking at something that's such a significant part of the GDP of the country, and you start talking about dramatically reducing the need for that. Well, that has an impact. I would argue it would be beneficial, but some people are going to be negatively impacted by reducing the need for chronic disease care, as sick as that sounds.
Yeah.
So, okay, now let's kind of bring it back and say, I just very quickly went over the fact that plant agriculture actually has a larger greenhouse gas emission than all of animal agriculture.
Very.
Isn't that in the... in the book you read, The Vegetarian Myth?
That was one of the things. I think she did talk about that, but she was focused on the wheat. She was focused on, you know, grain production.
The grains, yeah.
Which is
a big part of it,
I'm sure. It's so intensive, like for you
so
to take that and turn it into something
cereals.
That can be somewhat edible.
Well, right, exactly. Maybe, the problem is not the grain-fed cattle. The problem is the grain-fed people.
I love that.
See, that's another one that you posted a while back, and I thought that was so true.
If you're starving, you need it, right?
Yeah.
Yes.
So let's, you know, and it hasn't been that long that we've sort of, you know, transitioned from where, you know, food supply was always, you know, and it probably still is, but in ways that we don't appreciate. But it's been relatively recently that at least our portion of humanity has been faced with a situation that we're now faced with, which is not the impending threat of famine consistently. Right. So then we get to face, so calories do matter, right? Especially when we start talking about where they come from.
Ultimately, right.
You know, if you're going to lose body fat, you've got to burn some of that fat, why would you do that if you were eating more energy than you needed to expend?
Right.
So at some point, you know, the arguments that we use, and I understand why we use them, but they do matter. And so back to this idea of, you know, modern human beings in the sense of Homo sapien, not necessarily, you know, 2018, but, you know, Homo sapiens exist, because of ruminant animals. We didn't evolve to eat meat. We evolved because we ate meat.
Exactly.
So the ruminant animals were present like 20 million years ago in pretty much the form that they now exist. I think that there's like six families of them, and they all sort of go back to that time frame. Now, humanity is much more recent. So you had animals that were exploiting resources, the grasslands that were present, and then you have human beings coming along to occupy a niche and expand that. Right? We, because of our large brains, which arguably are the result of eating fat and meat, and opposable thumbs, which allow us to do very interesting things, and then because of our nature of exchanging goods and ideas with one another, this resulted in what we have today, and then you can have the luxury of arguing about, well, should we be doing it that way or should we be doing it this way? The reality is we can. Yeah. We're probably the only organism that's aware of its impact on the environment.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's exactly.
Yeah.
So there is something different about it. But to the point of, I need to find some people to help me work through this, but it's only been relatively recently that we've had the technology that would allow us to produce crops without plowing.
Wow. Oh, wow. Yeah. So like the technological advances. So
what is what are they relying on for their nutrition?
Well, the crops. So we're learning more about what happens in the soil when you have, you know, growing populations of plants and more importantly roots for a larger part of the year. So, you know, typically you would have somebody who plants corn, let's say in May, and then harvests it in September, and then that field would essentially remain open. They might, if they were rotating, plant something else for a long-term thing. But too often this was a clean cultivation. You know, they'd plow, they'd disc, they'd work the seed bed, plant the crop, then they'd harvest the crop, and then the next spring they'd sort of repeat the cycle, or at least, you know, till it to get a seed bed. One of the reasons for tillage is to control non-desirable plants that are there ready to come from seed that's in the soil. So that's been our pattern for the last, you know, 8 to 10,000 years, depending on what part of the world you look at. It's now you have people who are learning how to plant without tilling, to control the existing vegetation in any number of ways. There's a whole movement now in soil health and cover cropping. And then, interestingly enough, they're seeing that when they incorporate grazing animals into these cover crop no-till situations, they actually get a benefit beyond what they get when they don't have the animals present in the cover crop no-till situations.
This is so exciting. I think you mentioned this in your talk, and I think, I mean, it just seems like a no-brainer. What would stop someone beyond just plain ignorance from incorporating this strategy?
Well, there are some soils where it might not, you know, so it's there, again, there's no one size fits all, but in many parts of the country, this can work. But one of the things that's happened in the United States over time is we've had this sort of specialization take place. We've had farms go from producing, you know, maybe a dozen commodities each farm, something that they would sell for money, to where maybe now they only produce one or two or three.
Right.
And we've had this pattern of separation between those who are involved in animal agriculture and those who are involved in cropping agriculture. And there's lots of reasons why this happens. I don't want to just run by the idea that our dietary policy impacts our agricultural practices.
Of yes, course. Exactly. Why would you, as if you're not getting subsidized for a crop A and you are for crop B, then you're going to stick to crop B. And there's a bunch of other pressures beyond, I'm sure, just the subsidy.
Sure. I mean, if the market is saying we want this.
Right.
Oh, that too.
That's
yeah.
Exactly.
Then you respond to that by producing something that you can sell. When the market shifts, and this is a message that I'm trying to get out to my brethren in agriculture, first of all, I want them to get the message to the individual producers, right? Because whatever the conditions are in the general population, they're there in the farming population.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah, of course.
I'm sure they're there or worse.
If not worse, yeah.
Could be, you know, but in the sense that now we're talking about small, you know, the 90%+ of the farms in the United States are family-owned or that kind of a corporation, family corporation kind of business. They're not the image of what people have of big agriculture, right? If let's put it this way, if you were a farmer and you weren't incorporated, you would not be protecting your fiscal and financial well-being. Right?
Yeah, of course.
Corporation is a tool that's used to allow for succession, to enable certain, you know, tax advantages, et cetera, et cetera. It's not, but
protect you, your personal assets from liability.
Yeah. So too many people think they hear corporation and they think, you know, mega business. And it really isn't. Mega business is too smart to get involved in agriculture.
Yeah.
So you know, their niche is very happily upstream of the producer.
Right. Yeah, that makes sense.
So in any case, but these small businesses, they have employees, they have family members that are employed in this business, and healthcare is a huge issue there. Right? Yeah. First of all, they don't live near the big cities, so you're impacted there. And so the costs and insurance and all that kind of stuff. So all this ripples throughout. I want people to know the information that you know, that we know by going to keto. But they're not getting it when they go to their local cattlemen's meetings.
That's crazy because they would stand to. I mean, like you said, it's when you start talking about this, it makes my mind explode. Because yeah, you're right. Like there's so many.
It's like a rabbit hole.
Parts to it.
Yes, exactly. And I do get distracted by squirrels every once in a while. So. But yes, we need to improve the communication so that people can learn. And then I'm asking them, so if in fact we're approaching a tipping point where more people become aware that, no, I need to be eating the steak and eggs or the bacon and eggs for breakfast, and breakfast may not have to come till 11 o'clock. And, my main meal of the day needs to be, and then is it a chunk of fish, non-starchy vegetables? Is it, a steak? Is it poultry? What is it? Coupled with, appropriate other lifestyle choices, because there's lots of things we all can be doing to improve the quality of our lives. That will have a difference in the marketplace, and that will drive differences in the agricultural production. My concern is that, one, the message gets diverted by some not well-considered messaging about how this needs to be. There's lots of narratives, and they all are suspect when you start teasing. Most important thing for people to know is that they can go to their local supermarket, whatever that is. Is it Whole Foods or is it Piggly Wiggly? I don't care, right? Because the food that you can afford to buy there is safe, is healthful, right?
Yeah.
And buying one versus the other doesn't mean that you're going to be saving the planet, right?
Right.
Or destroying the planet. You need to go and find what's affordable to you, what's appropriate given your background and your life, and enjoy that, preferably with your family, so that you have all that richness that comes from meal pot, and avoid some of these other very problematic foodstuffs that take up majority of the supermarket space. And when we do that, we'll find that our health and our vitality improves, which will mean that our family life improves, which will mean that the life of the communities to which we belong will improve. And so all of that needs to be taken on board in any kind of conversation about what is now called sustainability.
Well, I think the main point is something. The main point from today is something that I didn't really look at it this way before. But based on what you've talked about today, is that we need to, even when we're talking about sustainability, we need to do a better job of talking about health. Which, honestly, it was something that I in the past was like, well, maybe we need to be able to better speak to. Environmental sustainability. I understand the importance of that still, but now it would make more sense for us to, because like you said, you're going to these meetings with industry and they are just not aware of the health concerns and what it means to me it's easier that way then, because obviously once we get there, like you said, when we get to the point where more people are eating meat and more people are seeing the health benefits, then when we talk about the messaging on how we do it, then of course that has to be well thought out. But we're going to do our part with that. First part is, you know, telling people, you know, what's healthy and sharing people's stories. But it was something that I was kind of looking at backwards before today's conversation. So I appreciate it.
Well, thank you for the opportunity. I really, you know, the secret to enlightenment is to lighten up.
Oh, I love it.
So let's not get too wrapped around the axle about, you know, production and these other issues that, you know, if we want to, we can sit down and we can have a conversation about them. But, you know, we may find, much to our chagrin, that modern agriculture actually is the sustainable option. Yeah. And it's not some of these other viewpoints that people have. Exactly the point of human health and flourishing ought to be the goal of each of us for our family, as well as looking at how can we do that to help people around the world who aspire to the same thing, but currently, you know, they don't have those options available. What's it going to take to enable that kind of development in a way that does protect, maybe even enhance the environments in which they live? So if I've contributed anything to the conversation or the thought process, I'm grateful for the opportunity.
You totally have. So I know that we're both on a time crunch, but I didn't want you to step off before you could share where people can find you and where people can learn more. Please hit us with all of them.
I live in Oregon. Oh, no. Oh, you mean online.
You live in
Oregon. I'm going to look for you in Oregon.
I'm just going to drive around. We really
want to
go to Oregon.
Yeah.
We're
dying
to go.
I'll notify. Yeah, I'll notify the authorities. be on the lookout for a really sweet, very large man. So you can find me on Facebook by name, but my page is called Grass-Based Health. And it's grass-based, not grass-fed. you can also find me on Twitter by the same grass-based. You can find me on Instagram as one word. Twitter and Instagram are one word, grass-based.
Awesome.
I do have a blog that occasionally I put stuff onto, and it is also grass-based health. You can find me on email as peter.ballerstead@gmail.com.
Well, very, thank you so
very
much.
Cool.
Yeah, thank you so much. And
we're gonna have to have you back on to finish the convo.
Yeah, we're gonna talk more about some of these. I think we can even title it like lies you've been told or something about the meat you're eating, because we have a very similar interest in this subject, and I think that it, especially nowadays with we're talking about meat, but then we're pigeonholing ourselves by, you know, denying people of delicious meat that just because it's not grown or raised a certain way. So that's definitely a conversation for next time.
Excellent. I look forward to it.
Well, have an awesome day. We want to thank you guys for listening. Make sure to subscribe and leave us a 5-star rating and review. That helps us get grow our audience so we can get more people like Dr. Ballerstead on. And I just want to thank you for joining us today, man.
Thank you so much, Doctor.
Yes.
You're more than welcome. It's been my pleasure.
All right. Have a good one.
We'll be right back.